This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West here on RN and the ABC Listen app. Now, this week marks 10 years since the beginning of the papacy of Francis, and in the next few weeks we'll review this often revolutionary period. In the meantime, though, go to the Religion and Ethics Report homepage to find an archive of our major stories, including a special program that I did from Buenos Aires in 2014 on how the city shaped the man. Now, could not turning up for church on Sunday morning have serious health effects? For 30 years, the United States has seen a steep increase in so-called deaths of despair. At the same time, there's been a major decline in religious participation. New research suggests the two trends could be linked. One of the researchers is economist Daniel Hungerman from the University of Notre Dame.
Deaths of despair refer to deaths from several different particular causes. So you've got poisonings, which typically refers to drug overdoses, suicides, and then deaths from liver disease, which is often driven by extensive drinking.
Now, if you look at the increase of these deaths over the past 20 to 30 years, as you and your two co-authors did, what happens when we lay these numbers over data about religious practice of the last 20 to 30 years?
When we compare deaths of despair to religious practice in the U.S., what we see is that one of them starts going up. Deaths of despair started going up, in particular for middle-aged Americans. Right at the same time, or maybe right after, we see a big decline in religious practice.
And we're not talking here specifically, because this is an important point, about religious belief. It's something about the practice, is that right?
Yeah, it's well known among scholars who study religion that there's a large decline in formal religious participation in the U.S., kind of starting in the early 1990s. But when you look at self-stated belief, how often people pray, things like that, those sorts of reported measures of religious participation were pretty constant during the 1990s. They weren't falling off the way that affiliation or attendance were falling off.
In addition to this research into deaths of despair, I mean, you've done a whole body of economic research into the public benefits, community benefits of religious practice. So what are we talking about here? It's the habits of social interactions.
There are actually several different stories. I think all of them are kind of plausible, but one might be a mutual insurance story. So when times get tough for you and you need support, either the support of a friend or financial support, that sort of insurance against bad times is something that a religious community might offer its members. So that would be one story, like a mutual insurance protection against bad times story. Another story is that religious groups may prevent their members from doing risky stuff, excessive drinking, gambling, you know, things like that, simply because they have rules and different prohibitions and prescriptions in place to try to guide the behavior of their adherents. That would be another story. And then a third story is that there's something about being part of this community that provides healthy mental benefits, being around different people, engaging with them, that sort of thing. That's part of it too. All of those different things, a community aspect, an insurance aspect, the rules and prescriptions aspect, they all might play a role in providing better outcomes for individuals.
Now, let's look specifically at one very fascinating aspect of your research, and that is the Blue Laws. Now, these were something that existed across many U.S. states. What were the Blue Laws?
Blue Laws are laws that restrict commerce on certain times of the week. Nowadays in the U.S., most people think of blue laws as being related to like alcohol sales. So for instance, where I live here in South Bend, Indiana, you cannot buy alcohol like beer, wine on Sunday mornings before noon. So if I walk into the grocery store, that aisle of the store is roped off so that people don't wander down it. But back in the day, blue laws were much more widespread. So if you go back to the 1960s or 70s in the United States, in most communities, everything was closed on Sunday mornings. And that's because in a lot of communities, there were actually laws that prohibited not just alcohol sales, but just commerce in general on Sunday mornings. Everything was closed.
So the lifting of these blue laws, what did it mean? A distraction from people going to church?
There's both the shopping issue, the distraction issue that you name, and there's also that work issue too. So if these laws got removed, a process that began with a Supreme Court decision in the 1960s in the U.S., then the mall opens up. And so some people want to go there and shop, and some people might have to go there to work. What we found in our research here was that once that mall opens up and people start leaving churches, there's an increase over the next few years in these sort of deaths of despair. So the exact same causes of death that were going way up in the 90s as religious participation fell. So among middle-aged Americans, you see increases in the very causes of death that seem to be moving in opposite patterns over time with religiosity. Is exactly what kind of got us into the study of blue laws in the first place in this context.
There's a racial element too, though, isn't it? Because why is there a greater impact in these deaths of despair among the white working and middle class?
That was a big part of our focus, was to look at differences across race. That started actually in the deaths of despair literature even before we showed up. One of the big mysteries in explaining the increase in deaths of despair that you see is that it's mainly driven by white middle-aged Americans, at least initially. In recent years, it's a little different. But most of the explanations you come up with, which might be, say, less educated white Americans have bad economic prospects or something like that, those same explanations might apply to minorities in the United States too. But you don't see the increases in mortality for them. One of the interesting things about the patterns we find is that the big decline in formal religious participation in the 1990s in the U.S., it actually is driven by white Americans. You don't really see the same sort of decline for blacks or other minorities in the United States. So it might offer an explanation for why deaths of despair rose just for white Americans. They were the ones who were seeing declines in religious participation at the same time.
This is really fascinating, Daniel, as we wind up, because as you say, if you look, for example, at the classic liberal Protestant denominations in the United States, traditionally attended by an upper middle class, they have also shriveled. Episcopalianism, for example, is almost a sect in the United States. Why don't we see, though, the same kinds of public health problems associated with the decline of liberal upper middle class religion?
When you say the same kinds of health problems, do you mean like for upper middle class individuals, you know, should we also be expecting these increases in deaths of despair and things like that?
Yes, especially considering we tend to have pathologized and medicalized a lot of things, especially depression, and that doesn't observe class boundaries.
That's true. For this particular case, I can tell you that the big drops that we were studying in this period in the 1990s, they're mainly driven not just by middle-aged Americans, which we've already talked about, not just by white Americans, as we were discussing a little bit ago, but also they're driven by less educated white Americans. So the trends that we're seeing at the start of this deaths of despair story, those are trends that are coming from less educated middle-aged whites. That's exactly the same group that saw big declines in religious participation over this era. For higher educated groups, the story is a bit more diffuse. It's more spread out over time. If there's anyone who's figured out a way to try to find some particular time in history where they can observe a big change in religious participation for those groups and then tie it to health outcomes, I haven't seen it yet, but I hope somebody can do an exploration like that. I'd love to learn what they would find.
Professor Daniel Hungerman is co-author with Tyler Giles and Tamar Ustrom of a fascinating new paper, Opiates of the Masses, Deaths of Despair and the Decline of American Religion. We'll put a link to that on our website. And Daniel is a professor at Notre Dame University. Thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And you're with me, Andrew West, on air and at the ABC Listen app. Around 400,000 Australian women aged 45 and over are at risk of homelessness. A Catholic organisation, the Xavier Social Justice Network in Melbourne, says the women are often the survivors of domestic abuse or have meagre retirement savings. In an essay for the online magazine Eureka Street, Xavier's coordinator, Danusha Kasker, warns of a social crisis.
The common image we have of a homeless person is an older man, usually rough sleeping and often suffering from alcoholism. And that's definitely been the case for many years. And when I started on the soup vans in the early 90s, it's probably what I would have noticed then.
And it continues to be a serious problem, a serious challenge to us as a society. But what does the new research tell us now?
What we're finding is that a new emerging cohort of people who are experiencing homelessness. And in the last ABS census in 2016, we found that women over 55 are the fastest growing group of people experiencing homelessness. That's actually double the number of any other group experiencing homelessness. So there was an increase in 31% from 2011 to 2016.
Yeah, in your piece for Eureka Street, which is based on a broader analysis you've done for the Xavier Social Justice Network, you say there could be as many as 400,000 women in Australia at risk of homelessness. Why?
The main key factors that we find, first of all, is domestic and family violence. So women and children fleeing domestic and family violence, often finding themselves preferring to sleeping in the car or taking other options rather than going home. Secondly, financial difficulties and the housing crisis. So women often find themselves experiencing discrimination because of the age and pay gap, lack of superannuation. Often they're working part-time or casual work due to being caregivers and, the, like I said, the gender pay gap. So the rising rental costs really does not allow them to be able to be part of the rental market.
Now, there's some significant Catholic teaching on this question, particularly around domestic abuse, including in the latest social justice statement from the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference. What does it say?
It's called Respect, Confronting Violence and Abuse, and the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference talks about domestic and family violence. And he talks about the staggering statistics that one woman is killed every 9 days by a current or former partner, and that we see one in six girls and one in nine boys experiencing physical or sexual abuse before the age of 15. So this is very prevalent in our society today. So some groups are also more vulnerable than others, and we find that there are 65% of women with disabilities who report at least one incident of violence by the time they age of 15.
There's a line particularly in the social justice statement that leapt out at me. The message of the gospel is not a message of domination of one person over another, but a message of mutual esteem and kindness. What sort of faith-based initiatives are going on to address the crisis in homelessness, especially for older women?
So the church recognises the importance of it being part of addressing this issue. So there are a number of great programs that are in place. For example, Catholic Care, Broken Bay's Safe Home is an example of a program that provides caseworker support, counselling and recovery for people experiencing domestic violence. There's also another program called Choosing Change. It's a program of Catholic Care in the Archdiocese of Sydney, and is specifically for men who perpetrate domestic violence. And we also have a number of different programs that support both the perpetrators and the victims of domestic violence. Mm.
It can't all, of course, be on the shoulders of faith-based organisations or volunteers. There has to be, I'm assuming, some government intervention here. What do you at the Xavier Social Justice Network want from governments?
So what we do is we try and raise these issues of advocacy and how we as a society need to change our mentality and our thinking. So we always ask, for example, asking why should she have to be the one to leave when she's experiencing domestic violence, rather than saying why doesn't he, the perpetrator, be removed from the house. So Macaulay's Safe at Home program is about women and children staying home safely, providing safe and affordable housing for them. And then also, this is a social justice issue. So if a woman decides to leave abusive home, that she is given safe and affordable housing options and she can start to rebuild her life, and providing the support that she needs through that process of transitioning.
I'm thinking specifically, though, do we need more pressure on governments, plural, for more social housing, for more emergency accommodation?
Yes. So quite often when I was in the soup van, if I encountered a woman fleeing domestic violence or being on the streets, and sometimes she would be in work attire, having worked for the day and afraid to go home that night, the lack of crisis accommodation beds and refuges at 9:30, 10 p.m. was really notable for me. So I think we need more crisis accommodation, more housing, affordable and safe housing options. We also need to talk about older people, the older generation, because out of all the homelessness services agencies in Australia, there's only 3 out of the 1,500 that are actually focused on the older person. So we really need to provide affordable rental accommodation for older people. And we find that only 0.5% of the properties that are available for rent in Australia would be affordable for a person on the age pension for a single person. So we have another program the government has, Home at Last, which is a homelessness service for older people. But we need many more initiatives like that so we can protect our older generation.
I have read of some interesting initiatives that effectively involve, well, they're basically share houses, long-term share houses for older women. Is that something that could really take off?
Yes, and I've actually have heard of this in a number of different situations, and our local minister was talking about this in my local council, about providing safe accommodation for women where they can live in a shared accommodation setting, and it's a place where they can pull resources and provide support to one another, emotional as well as the financial support, by sharing resources and accommodation together. So it's definitely a wonderful option. And I think a lot of these women have been through similar situations in life. And so there's the added bonus of empathy and compassion, understanding each other's situations as well. So I think that's a really wonderful possibility for it to continue on in the future.
Danusha Kasker of the Xavier Social Justice Network, read her article in Eureka Street. Is the party that has reshaped Scottish politics on the brink of a split? The Scottish National Party is in the throes of a very divisive leadership election after the resignation of First Minister Nicola Sturgeon. One candidate, Kate Forbes, is a member of the Conservative Free Church of Scotland, and she's got traditional views on sexual and gender identity. In an article for ABC Religion and Ethics Online, Miles Pattenden asks what the backlash against Forbes might mean for the role of personal faith in modern politics.
The controversy surrounding Kate Forbes started after the leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, resigned, and there is now a leadership contest to decide who to replace her. Kate Forbes is one of the leading candidates. She is an evangelical Christian who has a range of socially conservative views that don't necessarily chime very well with the wider membership of the Scottish National Party. So there's been quite a lot of public debate on this subject in Scotland and in the UK generally around the question of, well, what views do you need to hold or subscribe to in order to be able to participate in public life?
Yes, and what are a couple of those specific views that have enraged her opponents?
There are quite a few, it turns out. The original one is that she is essentially a gender critical feminist who opposes gender self-ID, which is the policy which probably brought down Nicola Sturgeon. But she also opposes gay marriage and has said on record that she would not have voted for it when it was passed by the Scottish Parliament in 2014. It now turns out, of course, also that her husband is a supporter of the Conservative Party. So all these things are anathema to certain strands of public opinion within the Scottish National Party, and she's having a very tough time of things.
On these lightning rod questions, though, of gender self-identification and same-sex marriage, hasn't Kate Forbes said that should she become the First Minister, she would defend the rights of all citizens, including sexual minorities?
She has said that, but it doesn't necessarily satisfy all parties. And that is the point at which the contention becomes significant, because there is, of course, an argument against her position, which is essentially she's saying, well, I don't agree with this, but I'll go along with the majority consensus. And people say, well, what if the majority consensus were to swing back to her view? Would she then favour rescinding it? Or to use a stronger example, what about her views about something like the legality of homosexuality? What if her acceptance of gay sex being legal was only dependent on the fact that a majority of people thought that? What does that say about her credentials as an upholder of human rights? Now, I know that's a hypothetical counterfactual, but those are the kinds of questions that we need to ask of political leaders, especially when they put themselves forward to lead a nation like Scotland.
Hmm. She is a member of the Free Church of Scotland. Now, that is different from the official Church of Scotland, which is Presbyterian. What is distinct about the Free Church of Scotland?
I'm not the person to ask about the specificities of different branches of Calvinism. The only thing which I particularly emphasise there is that they are a smaller church with a more radical theology and a more cohesive and committed membership. A lot of those members, like Kate Forbes, are, I understand, born-again Christians who have come to the church at some point in their lives. They don't necessarily have the same legacy of members who grew up in the faith and therefore sometimes have a slightly different relationship towards it than those who enter it later on, that they can see or they accept a different kind of range of contradictions or a role for their faith and their church and their life. And that may or may not be true in the case of Kate Forbes, but I think it's another one of the concerns that people have. It's very different to be someone like Joe Biden saying, well, you know, I'm a Catholic, because he grew up a Catholic, but nobody really believes that Joe Biden holds to everything that the Pope says. In fact, it's very obvious that he doesn't, and there are constant controversies over whether or not Catholic bishops should censor or sanction him for this. That's very different to somebody who voluntarily joins a church and signs up to a range of beliefs that other people may find unacceptable.
But interestingly, you argue that even though Kate Forbes's church, the Free Church of Scotland, a Calvinist church, has a very strict doctrine, historically, it's actually quite unlikely to want to impose its doctrine on wider society. Why?
This is a fascinating shift which has started to occur in Christianity at a much broader level, which interests me as an historian, that traditionally, as we know, many of the churches that were most active in what we might call social disciplining, that's controlling the behaviour and the morality of people subject to them, were the proselytizing churches or the ones that aimed for universal membership, such as the Catholic Church. And of course, we all know the story of things like the Holy Office and the Spanish Inquisition and their efforts to impose a sense of morality on Catholic populations. But Calvinists, Protestants, were somewhat different in that their basic belief system was to believe that, you know, they represented an elect group of people who would be saved, and they showed that they would be saved by their good example, by living a good and holy life. But they also believed that many other people were damned. And I mean, in that sense, it didn't necessarily matter what they did. But if your basic belief structure is that some people are saved and other people are damned, but that God decides this and it doesn't really matter on human agency, you're not under the same pressure to make everybody else behave correctly and conform to your moral standards that you are, or that leading Catholic clergy felt they were at various points in the past.
Mm. Yeah, it's a fascinating twist. Kate Forbes has won the backing of some rather unlikely supporters. So who are you talking about?
Well, one of the people who's come out in support of Kate Forbes is the lesbian feminist philosopher Kathleen Stock, who listeners may remember was hounded out of the University of Sussex for her gender-critical views. Since then, of course, she's become a great champion of freedom of speech in all contexts, and I think she very much sees this as one of those kind of issues that we need to draw a very perhaps a slightly subtle but very important distinction between saying it's very legitimate to criticise Kate Forbes's views and to question whether or not somebody who holds those social views is an appropriate candidate for First Minister. But that doesn't mean that she shouldn't be part of the political process. She should be free to make her arguments. When she puts herself forward, be required to explain herself rather than simply be handed off the stage.
Yes, and it's worthwhile quoting Kathleen Stock here writing. She said, "What we have is a clash of two religions. One of them is full of sanctimonious, swivel-eyed, moral scolds, rooting out heresy and trying to indoctrinate everybody into their fantastic way of thinking. The other is a branch of Calvinism." Have some of Kate Forbes's critics taken on their own form of religious fanaticism?
Yes, I think it's widely accepted in many circles that there are certain strands of progressive thought and activism which have become their own form of religion, if you'd like to use that terminology for it, that they are impervious to criticism or reason. And this is clearly, of course, one of the contexts to this is that that is what brought down Nicola Sturgeon as First Minister, her unconditional support for the idea that any man can define himself as a woman, even when it turned out that he's a convicted rapist and wanted to go to a woman's prison. Yet the intolerance of dissent or the unwillingness to accommodate counterexamples or contradictions or problems of that kind in the mode of thinking, it makes it look very religious and very fanatical. And Kate Forbes is in a sense, a sort of victim of that mode of thinking as well.
What do you see as the principle at stake in this case?
The basic principle at stake is what people can and can't say in public life and what views they can and can't hold. One thing I brought up in the article I wrote for ABC Online is this idea which the philosopher Karl Popper came up with of the sort of paradox of the liberal society, that a liberal society can only flourish when it doesn't tolerate intolerance. The difficulty in all these cases is always, well, how do you define intolerance? What's the threshold for that? And the problem we seem to have today is that the bar is set much too low. Simply because somebody says that they wouldn't personally support gay marriage is not necessarily a strong enough reason to exclude them from public life. We need to be capable as a society in Australia or in Britain or anywhere else of tolerating a wide diversity of opinions, many of which we don't like and which we often don't respect. A society which is sufficiently homogenous, in which we all more or less agree on the same values and same things, is going to be very boring and very susceptible to groupthink and would ultimately be far worse than the pluralist liberal democracies in which we live today.
Yeah. Is this controversy something that you see as likely to manifest itself at some point in Australia?
There's a sense in which we've skirted slightly around these controversies in Australia over the last few years. The Christian beliefs of Tony Abbott, of Dominic Perrottet, even of Scott Morrison have all been subject to scrutiny under the microscope, although in none of those cases has there been quite the same suggestion that the fact that they were Christians disqualified them from office or created this kind of jeopardy, which we've seen now several times in British politics. But one of my concerns is always that what happens in Britain or America eventually reaches Australia, because the Anglosphere is such a connected cultural system. So it's something that we must watch out for as Australians, and we must defend our right to hold pluralistic views on all kinds of subjects, including religion and gender.
Dr. Miles Pattenden. Miles is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University. He's also a visiting fellow at Peterhouse in Cambridge, which is where we've caught him now. Thank you for being on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much.
That is the show for today. You can find us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have an opportunity to leave us a review, please do so. Thanks to Hong Jiang and Russell Stapleton. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.